The Briefing Desk, Geopolitics. May 1st, 2026. Ukraine produces roughly 10 million drones per year. The United States produces approximately 100,000. That single statistic, offered by Alina Rybakova of the Kyiv School of Economics on the CSIS podcast Russian Roulette, captures something fundamental about how the nature of industrial warfare has shifted since February 2022, and why the implications of that shift reach far beyond the front lines in eastern Ukraine. But the same conflict that has driven Ukraine's extraordinary manufacturing transformation is also, paradoxically, feeding the fiscal reserves of the country trying to destroy it. The ongoing U.S. military confrontation with Iran, now in its 16th day, carries with it an estimated $150 billion in additional oil revenues for Moscow over approximately 6 months. Rybakova's assessment is stark. That figure is roughly equivalent to Russia's entire official defense and security budget for 2026. It would, in effect, allow the Kremlin to double its near-term military spending at precisely the moment when structural economic deterioration had begun to bite. We begin where much of the military picture begins this week, on the ground in Ukraine, where a defensive line described as visible from space is taking shape along the country's northern frontier. Brigadier General Vasil Siritenko, identified by Ukrinform as Chief of Engineering Troops of the Support Forces Command of Ukraine's Armed Forces, has described a major new defensive construction project stretching from the Kyiv Reservoir southward through Sumy Oblast. The scale is significant. According to United 24 Media, as cited by the military show, the defensive depth extends approximately 100 kilometers, roughly 62 miles, with the most intensive fortifications concentrated within the first 20 kilometers of the front line. Russia's state news agency TASS, citing an unnamed expert operating near the front, reported the construction spans three districts of Sumy region, proximate to Russia's Kursk territory, incorporating minefields and what it described as decoy positions. The strategic logic behind this construction is inseparable from events that began in August 2024, when Ukrainian forces launched a cross-border incursion into Russia's Kursk region, seizing over 1,000 square kilometers, approximately 400 square miles, of Russian territory. The military show reported that figure, and also cited Commander-in-Chief Oleksandr Sirsky's assessment that Russia suffered more than 80,000 casualties during its subsequent counteroffensive to reclaim that ground. That counteroffensive ultimately succeeded in pushing Ukrainian forces back, and the new defensive line is, in part, Ukraine's answer to the vulnerability that operation exposed. Sirsky, speaking on April 22nd, stated that Russia has been regrouping units and moving reserves toward front lines, with a new offensive anticipated. His assessment, as reported by the military show, identified Donetsk and the broader Donbas region as the primary anticipated axes of Russian pressure, while also flagging Sumy Oblast as an area of continued Russian interest. On April 13th, the Kyiv Independent reported that Ukrainian forces had already withdrawn from a number of villages in Sumy Oblast, with troops regrouping around Miropilsky. Ukraine's 14th Army Corps described the withdrawal in a Facebook statement cited by the military show not as a retreat, but as a repositioning to preserve personnel. Open-source intelligence outlet Deep State assessed that Russian activity in Sumy currently consists primarily of probing operations, infiltration attempts covering approximately 150 square kilometers, rather than a major offensive push. Military analyst Oleksandr Kovalenko, cited by the military show, offered a blunt verdict. Ukraine should have constructed defensive lines of this kind years earlier. Building on that assessment, a report from UNN, also cited by the military show, offered some reassurance that Russia does not currently possess sufficient forces in its border regions or in Belarus to achieve a breakthrough of the depth represented by the new line. On the question of human cost, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky posted on April 28th, cited by the military show that approximately 60% of Russian casualties are irrecoverable. That term carries a specific military meaning, killed outright or so severely wounded as to preclude a return to frontline service. United 24 Media's March figures, 35,351 total Russian casualties for that single month, of which 21,210 were categorized as irrecoverable, offer a window into the grinding attrition that Zelensky argued is pushing Russia toward expanded mobilization. Separately, the military show cited at least 15,578 Ukrainian civilians killed and 43,352 wounded as a result of Russian attacks, though the source and time period for those totals were not specified in the available reporting. Against that backdrop of frontline pressure and defensive construction, Ukraine's defense industrial transformation represents what may be the most consequential long-term shift in the conflict's character. Alina Rybakova, non-resident senior fellow at both the Peterson Institute for International Economics and the Bruegel think tank in Brussels, and director of the International Affairs Program at the Kyiv School of Economics, described on the CSIS podcast Russian Roulette what she called a dramatic decentralization of Ukraine's defense industrial base since 2022. The Soviet-era legacy enterprises that once dominated the sector have given way to a private sector-driven ecosystem operating with a speed and adaptability that would be difficult to replicate in most other national contexts. The numbers tell the story. In 2025, drones accounted for 80-85% of all frontline strikes. FPV drones, first-person view systems used for direct strike missions, cost between $500 and $2,000 per unit. Drone-supported logistics missions, including ammunition resupply and medical evacuation, increased more than 5 times over the prior year, and Ukraine's total annual production has reached approximately 10 million units. For comparison, Rybakova cited U.S. annual output at roughly 100,000. The gap is not a matter of degrees, it is a fundamentally different order of scale. What makes the Ukrainian system particularly difficult to counter is the feedback loop built into it. Rybakova described a process in which underperforming drones can be pulled from the front line within days, with brigade-level repair shops using three-dimensional printing to modify components and test new configurations. The iteration cycle between field failure and design modification has compressed to a degree she assessed as essentially impossible to replicate through conventional defense procurement pathways. Rybakova also identified a significant gap between Ukraine's current production and its potential. She estimated that Ukraine holds between $25 billion and $40 billion in defense-related production capacity that remains unactivated due to insufficient capital investment, and she noted that estimate may now be conservative. Part of the reason for this underutilization has been a de facto export ban on Ukrainian military production, though she assessed that policy has been shifting since January 2026, when President Zelensky announced changes permitting Ukrainian companies to establish operations abroad. The competitive dimension of this industrial race is not entirely favorable to Ukraine. CSIS senior fellow Maria Snegovaya noted that a CSIS report by researcher Kate Ponder assessed Russia has demonstrated significant capacity to rapidly adapt and replicate Ukrainian drone innovations, including applications involving artificial intelligence. Snegovaya cited Alexei Chudayev, director of the Russian Scientific Research Center Ushkunik, as having stated publicly that if current conditions continued, Ukraine might advance ahead of Russia in this domain. The framing is striking, a Russian official effectively acknowledging Ukraine's technological edge as a near-term possibility. On the conventional missile front, Ukraine's defense manufacturing trajectory extends beyond drones. Ukrainian manufacturer Firepoint presented mock-ups of 2 ballistic missiles at an event in Poland linked to the April Road to Ukraine Recovery Conference, according to Defense Express, cited by the military show. The two systems, designated the FP9 and the FP7, represent a meaningful step change in Ukraine's long-range strike ambitions. The FP9, based on Defense Express's analysis of the mock-up presented, is approximately 9.5 meters in length and 1.1 meters in diameter. Firepoint states it will have a range of 855 kilometers, roughly 531 miles, and will be capable of carrying a conventional warhead of up to 800 kilograms. For context, Russia's Iskander-M ballistic missile has a range of up to 500 kilometers, with a warhead of up to 700 kilograms. The FP9 would substantially exceed those parameters. Firepoint expects the system to be codified for Ukrainian armed forces use at some point during summer 2026. The shorter-range FP7, designed for strikes at approximately 200 kilometers, has already been undergoing live-fire testing since at least February, according to Defense Express. An April 6 report from United 24 Media quoted FP9 designer Dennis Stillerman, confirming development of an air-launched variant of the system. The military show assessed analytically, without a stated specification from Firepoint, that an air-launched variant fired from fighter jets could approach the 1,500-kilometer minimum range of Russia's Kh-47M2 Kinzhal hypersonic missile. For reference, the Block 1 ATACMS, the longest-range surface-launched system the United States has provided, has a range of 165 kilometers. The NATO dimension of Ukraine's drone capabilities carries its own unsettling implications. Rybakova cited a NATO military exercise conducted in Estonia, in which a small Ukrainian drone team effectively neutralized two NATO battalions in a single day. NATO forces were reportedly unable to deploy their own drone assets in response. The cost asymmetry she described is stark. A drone costing as little as $20,000 may require a defensive interceptor battery costing up to $4 million to destroy. At sufficient volume, that arithmetic makes large-scale drone interception economically unsustainable. On the margins of this industrial picture, and worth noting for its unusual character, the Italian Senate has introduced a bill to create a mechanism for transferring decommissioned fishing nets to Ukraine, per Militarni, as cited by the military show. The intended use is repurposing those nets as drone netting, a makeshift but pragmatic form of aerial defense. Whether that bill has passed was not indicated in the available reporting. Turning to Russia's economic position, the picture presents a paradox that Rybakova described plainly on CSIS: structural deterioration in the domestic economy, combined with a potentially transformative near-term revenue windfall from the Iran conflict. On the structural side, Rybakova assessed the Russian economy as having stalled. While Russia has continued to report positive GDP figures, she anticipated negative growth is likely in the current period. Investment goods are running approximately 25% below 2024 levels. Construction output has declined significantly. Agricultural output has also dropped. Domestic demand exists, but is being met increasingly through imports. A consequence, she assessed, of an overvalued ruble that makes foreign goods artificially cheap while suppressing domestic industrial activity. Dr. Jason Smart, identified on KEF Post as a national security advisor, added further texture to that picture. He stated that Russia's national budget deficit has already exceeded its projected full-year level, and this has occurred only months into the calendar year. The Russian banking sector, he stated, is facing liquidity problems driven by government withdrawals without repayment. Smart also noted that Russia spends billions of dollars annually procuring components, microchips among them, that are no longer available through normal channels due to Western sanctions, adding a significant structural drag to the defense industrial base. And yet, sitting alongside these structural pressures is the Iran variable. Rybakova's assessment that the ongoing U.S.-Iran confrontation could generate approximately $150 billion in additional oil and gas revenues for Russia over 6 months is consequential precisely because of the timing. She described Russia's reserve position as significantly depleted, by 4+ years of war financing. A windfall of this scale, arriving at this moment, could effectively reset the Kremlin's fiscal clock, allowing Moscow to sustain military expenditure well beyond what its deteriorating domestic economy would otherwise permit. The internal political picture is more nuanced than Russian state media presents. CSIS senior fellow Maria Snegovaya referenced an approximately 7 percentage point decline in President Putin's approval ratings in official polling, a decline that, while modest by Western standards, is notable in a system in which official figures are structurally designed to reflect stability. She cited public commentary by Victoria Bonia, a reality television personality with a large Russian social media following residing in Monaco, as an example of previously apolitical figures expressing public discontent. Bonia posted a video message to Putin stating directly that people in Russia fear him. The state media response was instructive. Russian state television presenter Vladimir Solovyov publicly attacked Bonia and appealed to Russia's investigative committee, requesting an examination of her activities, a significant escalation against someone who had, until that point, been largely outside the political sphere. The effect was the reverse of what the Kremlin presumably intended. Bonia reported gaining 600,000 new subscribers in 6 days following the confrontation, according to the War and Politics 24 transcript. She noted, pointedly, that this figure compared favorably to Solovyov's total Instagram following. Rybakova offered a structural reading of Russian political dynamics that helps contextualize these episodes. She described a recurring pattern in Russian political crises: scapegoating of regional governors and technocrats when outcomes deteriorate. And she noted that even the Kremlin's most loyal media ecosystem is showing stress. Pro-Kremlin bloggers are experiencing audience declines because their followers are less likely to use VPNs to circumvent the internet disruptions that Russia's own censorship infrastructure has created. On the diplomatic front, a TASS readout of a telephone call between President Trump and President Putin, as read on the Promethean Updates program, stated that Putin told Trump he was ready to declare a ceasefire during the Victory Day celebrations on May 9th, and that Trump actively supported the initiative. The same readout characterized both leaders as describing the Zelensky government as pursuing a policy of prolonging the conflict with European support. The program did not present an independent Ukrainian or White House response to that framing. The U.S. confrontation with Iran entered its 16th day as of April 30, 2026, according to Fox News reporting, cited in the Rubin Report transcript, and by the metrics being publicly discussed, its economic impact on Iran is severe. President Trump, speaking to Axios, was quoted directly: "The blockade is somewhat more effective than the bombing. They are choking like a stuffed pig, and it's going to be worse for them. They can't have a nuclear weapon." Trump stated the blockade would be extended until Iran agrees to a deal ending its nuclear program and rejected Iran's most recent offer. The contents of that offer were not detailed in the available reporting. Fox News reported the following economic indicators attributed to the conflict: 2 million jobs lost in Iran, half of Iran's jobs described as at risk, the value of Iran's currency down 98% to a record low, annual inflation up 67%, the price of chicken, a basic food staple, up 75%, and Iran's daily oil shipments down 70%. These are figures as reported by Fox News. The Rubin Report transcript does not identify the original sourcing body beyond the Fox News broadcast. Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth, appearing before a congressional hearing, described the military operation as, in his words, an astounding military success. Massachusetts Representative Seth Moulton characterized the situation as a, quote, quagmire. Hegseth disputed that characterization directly. Brent Johnson of Santiago Capital, speaking on the Thoughtful Money channel, stated that on a purely military basis, the United States has absolutely dominated the confrontation, while also acknowledging that U.S. forces have absorbed hits. He noted that at least one carrier was reportedly displaced from an operating position of approximately 500 miles from Iranian territory to approximately 1,500 miles. The strategic logic behind the Iran operation, as assessed by Johnson and host Adam Taggart on Thoughtful Money, extends well beyond the bilateral confrontation. Johnson argued the conflict is, in his framing, really all about China, that denying China access to Iranian and Venezuelan energy supplies constitutes a calculated move in a broader strategic competition. Building on that argument, he assessed that control over Persian Gulf oil flows and Venezuelan energy reserves could provide significant bargaining leverage heading into a prospective Trump-Xi meeting described as occurring in the coming weeks, though no external source confirmed the meeting's date, venue, or agenda. The downstream risks from Strait of Hormuz disruption are not purely geopolitical. Johnson stated that even if the strait were to reopen fully and immediately, the approximately 6-week period of disruption already incurred will produce knock-on effects in food and energy markets 6 to 9 months from now. His reasoning, disrupted shipping and elevated energy costs have interrupted agricultural cycles, insufficient fertilizer application, incomplete planting seasons, particularly across Europe, Asia, and emerging market economies. He drew an analogy to the 2014-2015 period, arguing that elevated energy and food prices generated social unrest across a range of states. And here the strategic picture loops back to Russia. As Rybakova assessed on CSIS, the Iran conflict creates the estimated $150 billion oil revenue windfall for Moscow described earlier. The dynamic is perverse in its structure. Washington's military campaign against Tehran is simultaneously strengthening the fiscal position of the adversary Washington is trying to isolate in Europe. The policy tension between those two objectives, pressuring Russia over Ukraine while engaging militarily with Iran, is not resolved anywhere in the available reporting. One potential counterweight to that windfall is secondary sanctions. Robertson, described as an Irish journalist on the Warren Politics 24 program, identified India and Turkey as among the top buyers of Russian energy exports, and argued that secondary sanctions threats against those buyers could meaningfully reduce Russian revenues. He characterized that policy instrument as underused by Western governments. Neither economic data nor official government responses were cited in support of that argument. Remaining in the broader conflict zone and in territory that carries risks of a different order of magnitude, the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant continues to operate under conditions that Robertson, speaking on the Warren Politics 24 program, described in stark terms. Russia controls the facility, which Robertson characterized as Europe's largest nuclear plant and larger than Chernobyl. He stated the plant is operating with intermittent power supplied by diesel backup generators that power the water pumping stations cooling the nuclear fuel. Failure of those generators and the resulting cooling failure could produce what he described as an environmental and health hazard of global scale. The transcript does not include an independent technical assessment or corroboration from the International Atomic Energy Agency or any other named institutional source. These are Robertson's stated positions, offered as analysis rather than as verified fact. Robertson also stated that in 2024, Russian forces fired a drone into the protective containment shield built by the international community over the Chernobyl reactor site, citing this as evidence of Russian indifference to nuclear risk. No independent confirmation of this event appears in the transcript. His most provocative argument was structural rather than tactical. Robertson argued that the institutional conditions that enabled the 1986 Chernobyl disaster, a hierarchy in which engineers were too afraid to report problems to superiors, remain operative within the current Russian state. He identified the most probable risk scenario at Zaporizhia not as deliberate sabotage but as negligence and failed internal communication. He noted that Russian state media produced an alternative version of the Chernobyl disaster, attributing it to the CIA, which he presented as evidence that Soviet institutional logic, with its preference for external attribution over internal accountability, has not fundamentally changed. No institutional counterargument is presented in the available transcript. Beyond the immediate conflict zones, several concurrent developments are reshaping the institutional infrastructure of global oil and dollar markets, though it is important to note that sourcing for a number of these developments rests primarily on analyst commentary rather than official statements. The UAE has announced its departure from OPEC. Adam Taggart, on the Thoughtful Money channel, described OPEC as having been a dominant force in oil markets since the early 1980s, making the UAE's exit a genuinely significant structural shift. Brent Johnson of Santiago Capital described the move plainly as a very big deal. Johnson's interpretation of the UAE's motivation is worth unpacking. He assessed that the UAE's revenues from oil exports have been curtailed by recent market conditions, creating dollar funding needs. More importantly, in his reading, the UAE is positioning itself strategically in alignment with the United States following the Iran conflict, and a recently signed US-UAE swap line agreement, he argued, binds the UAE more closely to the dollar system. That framing matters because it runs directly counter to the de-dollarization narrative that has circulated in financial commentary in recent years. Johnson explicitly rejected that narrative. He noted that when China established international swap lines in prior years, some analysts celebrated it as a strategic victory for Beijing. The same logic, he argued, should lead observers to recognize U.S. swap line agreements as strategic wins for Washington. No official UAE government statement or Federal Reserve confirmation of the swap line agreement is cited in the transcript. On Russia and the SWIFT international payment system, Taggart referenced news emerging earlier in the week that the United States may be opening the door for Russia to return to the network from which it was excluded following the 2022 invasion. Johnson said this development is consistent with his long-standing argument that countries seek dollar system access even when their stated policy positions suggest otherwise. He cited Putin's reported prior statement, "We didn't leave the dollar left us," as an illustration of the underlying dynamic. No named newswire source is cited for the swift development in the available transcript. On BRICS, the coalition of Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa subsequently expanded. Johnson offered a direct assessment. The bloc has not made a material impact on the world in terms of actual financial flows. He described the volume of transactions transiting BRICS-affiliated payment mechanisms as completely de minimis. He cited, without a named source, that Indian Prime Minister Modi said this week he is not in favor of BRICS trading in local currencies rather than the dollar, a position that, if accurate, would represent a significant blow to the bloc's monetary ambitions. Johnson also described stablecoins, dollar-denominated digital tokens typically pegged one-to-one to the U.S. currency, as likely to be, in his words, as transformative to the global economy as when the United States left the gold standard. His firm, Santiago Capital, has been adding positions reflecting that view. On commodity markets more broadly, Johnson described what he sees as the end of what economists call the law of one price, the principle under which the same commodity trades at comparable prices across global markets. Natural gas already trades at dramatically different prices in different regions. Oil is moving in that direction. Johnson's assessment is that food prices may follow, creating a world in which regional price divergence becomes structurally embedded rather than a temporary anomaly. The Thoughtful Money transcript does not cite agricultural agency data, food price indices, or shipping data providers to substantiate these projections. Domestically within the United States, the Supreme Court issued a ruling this week that will reshape the legal architecture of congressional redistricting ahead of the 2026 midterm elections. The court ruled 6-3 to strike down Louisiana's 2024 congressional map, which had been redrawn to create a second majority black district, as an illegal racial gerrymander. The decision was authored by Justice Samuel Alito, per President Trump's statement quoted in the Rubin Report transcript. In practical terms, the ruling narrows states' use of race as a factor in drawing congressional districts, and will require plaintiffs challenging maps to prove racially discriminatory motive, rather than relying on Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act as an affirmative mandate for the creation of minority-majority districts. Justice Clarence Thomas, quoted via Fox News, stated he would go further still, holding that Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act does not regulate redistricting at all. The dissenting bloc, Justices Elena Kagan, Sonia Sotomayor, and Ketanji Brown Jackson, warned that Section 2 has been rendered, in their words, essentially a dead letter, and that minority citizens in affected states will no longer have an equal opportunity to elect candidates of their choice. Molly Hemingway, editor-in-chief of The Federalist, stated on the Glenn Beck program that the ruling found Section 2 could not be interpreted to require racially based district maps, characterizing such an interpretation as contrary to the intent of the legislators who originally passed the Voting Rights Act. She noted the ruling addresses only racial gerrymandering. It does not eliminate partisan gerrymandering, which remains legally distinct. The political reactions tracked predictable fault lines. President Trump issued a statement calling the decision a big win for equal protection under the law. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer called it despicable and a return to Jim Crow. House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries called the ruling unacceptable and said it represented an effort by what he called the Trump Court to suppress the vote and rig the midterm elections. CNN analysts assessed the decision as likely to open the door for more Republican congressional seats in southern states. CNN political commentator Scott Jennings offered a counter-argument worth noting. He cited the current figure of 58 black members of the House, described as a record, with a majority elected from plurality white districts. His argument was that drawing districts explicitly by race is, in his framing, inherently racist, and that black political representation has in fact expanded under a system that does not depend on racially constructed districts. The transcript notes that 83% of black voters supported Kamala Harris in the 2024 election, attributed to a statistic cited during the broadcast without a named polling source. The ruling's downstream consequences are already visible at the state level. The Florida State Senate passed a new congressional redistricting map with a final vote of 83 yeas and 28 nays, expected to be signed by Governor Ron DeSantis on the day of broadcast. Florida State Representative Angie Nixon called the map a violation of the Constitution. We close where this briefing's deeper strategic logic ultimately leads, to the question of whether Ukraine can sustain the economic and diplomatic conditions necessary to continue fighting while simultaneously building the industrial base that could redefine it as a defense exporter. Rybakova on CSIS cited the Kyiv School of Economics forecast of 2.3% GDP growth for Ukraine in 2026, a figure that has already been revised downward from an earlier projection of approximately 3 to 3.5%. Inflation is running at approximately 9% for the year, up from an earlier forecast of 7%. Ukraine's monetary policy interest rate stands at 15%, the same, Rybakova noted, as Russia's, reflecting the pressure both economies are under in very different ways and for very different reasons. Ukraine's ability to sustain war financing, Rybakova assessed, remains dependent on external partner support. The country carries a large trade deficit driven by structural war-related imports, and a significant fiscal deficit caused by military expenditure. She referenced a 90 billion euro figure in the context of European financial support, linked to the political transition in Hungary following what she described as Viktor Orban's electoral defeat, an outcome she assessed as unlocking further European cooperation with Ukraine. The transcript does not provide additional detail on the composition or timeline of that figure. On Gulf state diplomacy, Rybakova offered an assessment that reframes Zelensky's regional travel as something more than ceremonial outreach. The Gulf states, she argued, view the United States as both unreliable and unable to produce the required volume of affordable interceptor systems to defend their economic infrastructure from aerial threats. Iranian Shahed drones used against Gulf targets were described as less sophisticated than the systems Russia has deployed against Ukraine, implying that Ukrainian air defense solutions developed against more advanced threats may be particularly well suited to Gulf requirements. For Ukraine, this creates a diplomatic and commercial opening that could, over time, reduce its dependence on Western support while generating export revenues that reinvest into its own defense industrial base. Rybakova also noted the governance dimension of Ukraine's wartime condition. IMF-style compliance checklists, she assessed, are not always the most effective mechanism for driving reform in Ukraine's specific context. She identified judicial training and procurement reform as areas of long-term structural importance. And she noted an uncomfortable political reality. The current Ukrainian government has remained in power for an extended period without elections, a condition she described as unique and attributable to the legal constraints of wartime, but one that carries its own institutional risks over time. The picture that emerges from this week's reporting is one of extraordinary complexity and compounding interdependencies. Ukraine is building defensive lines and ballistic missiles simultaneously. Russia is economically strained but may be on the verge of a significant fiscal reprieve delivered, inadvertently, by American military action in the Persian Gulf. Iran is being squeezed by a blockade whose strategic purpose may be as much about Beijing as it is about Tehran. And the legal architecture of American democracy is being renegotiated in real time, district by district, ahead of a midterm cycle whose outcome will shape the foreign policy capacity of the United States for years to come. None of these threads resolve cleanly. All of them continue. Thank you for listening. That's your geopolitics briefing from the Briefing Desk for May 1st, 2026. We'll be back tomorrow with the next development across these and other stories unfolding on the international stage. We hope you'll join us.